This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
Good. All's well, Nathan.
Pretty well. How are you, Nate?
Doing pretty good. It's July 6th, which is the 2-year anniversary of the beginning of Fasting Escape. So I'm really good.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thanks in a large part to Dr. Lyle's expertise and just support through all this. So it's just happens to be the second on the day. So we are recording now July 6th.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to many, many more years. But it's also episode 228 and or 229, maybe. I'll have to edit that out. But we have had some updates, and we're going to have some questions. One of our questions is about coronavirus, COVID-19, and so we'll just take it away. You guys ready?
Sure.
Sure.
All right, dear doctors, I've been following Jeffrey Miller's Twitter during the past couple months and noticed that his worldview is trending to become a little more conservative and traditionalist. In light of the unprecedented level of social conflict we are currently experiencing, this is something that resonates with me. Once I began to understand the principles of evolutionary psychology, I began to see the hidden wisdom in tradition. I noticed that Dr. Lyle does not seem to place much value on traditional behaviors, and I always thought this was curious. Can you ask him to speak to this?
Well, why ask me? Let's ask Jen.
Far, far better to make observations on someone else's thoughts and opinions and behavior.
Yep.
Well, I also follow Jeffrey Miller on Twitter. I don't think you even are on Twitter, are you, Doug?
No.
It doesn't strike me as a thing that you do. So, yeah, I follow Jeffrey Miller and have for some time. And I wouldn't say that he's becoming more conservative or traditionalist than he ever was. I think maybe with a lot of upheaval in the world, you're sort of seeing more of the core of his worldview on display. But I'm assuming what this person is talking about is he just got married. He's in a somewhat non-traditional relationship himself, which is a little ironic, but he's adhering to traditional institutions, and he's interested in, I think it's fair to say that he's sort of interested in upholding those institutions like marriage. He's very pro-natalist. He believes that, you know, people really should be having children and investing in child rearing. He's interested in sort of traditional forms of architecture and domestic family arrangements and all this kind of stuff. And he also rails more than anybody else in the EP world against, what he and a lot of us call virtue signaling. So that may be also what this person is talking about. He's, really upset about the ways in which people mobilize around flashpoints in the media and in world events to satisfy their own competitive avoidant goals, which is not much different than we're approaching the world on this podcast or in the other work that we're doing. So I guess if there's a divergence from his worldview and Doug's in the sense that he's putting more of a value on traditional behaviors. He might be, because he's not a clinician, I think he's less sensitive to the variety of life experiences that satisfy people along different points on the bell curve. So he's a little more just like most academics are. They sort of want to triangulate in on the capital T truth for everybody, for the human experience. And so this is what academic work is all about. You're trying to kind of identify the essence of the question that you're looking at, or the problem that you're working on. And there's not a lot of interest in or sensitivity to the fact that there's a different optimal equilibrium for everybody, depending on who they are, which is something that we're up close and personal with working clinically. So, you know, maybe traditional institutions and traditional values like marriage, like a single family home, like having children, whatever else that he might recommend or advocate for, that's a perfectly good life path for a lot of people, perhaps even most people, but it's not for everybody. And so we're always really sensitive when we're talking to people or answering these questions to, like, okay, well, yeah, maybe quote unquote society is telling you something is the correct thing to do, but that may or may not be the ideal circumstances for you personally or for your relationship. So I can see that, you know, if you listen to us for any amount of time, we're much more open-minded about what kind of set of circumstances might be best for you, which might look much less traditional than whatever Jeffrey Miller's advocating at any particular point in time. But that would just be my guess based on peeping his Twitter feed now and then.
Yeah, I think that's very, very insightful. And I think that, like, I don't know. What's strange to me, though, Jen, is Miller, like, I don't know what his Twitter feed looks like and what it's been looking like lately. But, you know, Spent was pretty wild. In other words, the second half of Spent, he just goes off the rails in a, I think it was tongue in cheek, you know, I think it was, but he was really quite critical of the current economic landscape. In other words, his attitude was it all ought to be run by Plato's social scientists. And and that we should have social scientists figuring out what really makes people happy and then having them in jobs, figuring out what would be good for people to do. I mean, it was really wacky. It had zero correspondence with any reality other than some bizarre top down, you know, statist government where the academics were in charge of everybody's economic life. It was so out there, and I knew that Miller spent, you know, a couple of years at the London School of Economics, and so he's well versed. He's argued with free market libertarians, I'm sure, until 4 a.m. It's not like he's not aware of the value of free minds, free markets, et cetera, et cetera. But his argument in Spent was sort of extraordinarily radical. So it's interesting that this person is saying, you know, more conservative. I don't know if there is, does he signal a, a right-leaning libertarian-esque political mm-hmm. philosophy? Is that kind of what he smells like?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's particularly if you've been reading him recently mm-hmm. in light of the protests and COVID and everything else, he is very, like, you could characterize him as sort of pro-police, you know, if you had uh-huh. to really pigeonhole him.
Yeah.
It's right-leaning, you know, patriotic.
Yeah.
You know, these protests are destructive.
Yeah.
You know, pro-meritocracy.
Right.
You know, very concerned about the tyranny of the minority.
Yes.
Really, really interested in upholding long-standing successful institutions of liberal democracy.
Yeah.
But doing so through, I mean, I think he does remain a really very much an individualist.
Yes.
And he would be very upset if this were interpreted as me saying, oh, Jeffrey Miller, you know, thinks that everybody should live their lives the same way and do the same thing. I don't think he believes that at all. I think he's a champion for individual choice and individual expression.
Yeah.
But within the context of a certain constitutional structure that mm-hmm. has, you know, proven itself over the last couple of centuries.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's like as he gets older, he gets a little more like me. Whenever anybody has a sort of pretty wild kind of talk that he had at the end of Spent, my first thought is always, oh, well, you haven't made any money. Like, right. you want to burn it down and reorganize the whole thing, which means you're frustrated. Okay, so I don't have any idea if that's true or not, but yes, it's interesting because he certainly is would strike me as at his core sort of a classical liberal, pretty open minded, academic. And so it's like as he's gotten a little older and feeling that age and sort of looking at everything, it's like, listen, we want everybody to have free speech, but we don't want anybody burning anything. It's kind of that
totally.
That would make sense to me. You know, please express yourself. And he would be, I think, probably himself being, a recipient of being able to speak up even under some scary mild oppression in academia, which I think hurt him. I think that hurt his career in terms of what his career could have been. Jeffrey Miller, for people, the reason we're even talking about him this much is he's brilliant. He's a, it doesn't mean everything he says is right, but the guy is flat out brilliant. And he's been at the forefront of some really striking new, domains of thought in evolutionary psychology. And so, but at the same time, he's not quote done that well in academia, according to his terrific pedigree and his ingenuity. So that I think led him to be somewhat bitter as of 2012 or whatever it is that he wrote Spent. But now I feel like maybe he's come full circle. More success personally and professionally, and now he's sort of feeling like, hey, let's reel it in and let's make it a little more conservative. Let's not be too wild here, everybody. That's what it sounds like to me. Does that feel like a good guess?
Yeah, I think that's totally what comes across. But yeah, he's by all rights the guy should be, teaching. Some bitterness about his lack of ascendancy in academia is totally fair. He's at the University of New Mexico, and he should be, at Princeton.
Harvard.
Or
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Yeah. It's not quite that brilliant. Okay.
We already have Steven Pinker anyway. They'd be fighting all the time.
Yeah.
But I think he's with Twitter and, just a general more public presence in the world. He's got 100,000 followers on Twitter, and he's a regular presence. I think he is able to feel like he's got a little more status in the village, and that's put him in a better position of power, which is good for evolutionary psychology. And good for him. And he's really a valuable voice.
Get a little bit of gray hair, you get a little bit more conservative. So I understand. It makes perfect sense.
Settled down with Diana, and they want kids, and so he's thinking about the future that his kids are going to inherit, and all of those things tend toward more traditionalism, I think, just naturally.
Sure. Makes sense. All right. All great, Nathan. Terrific.
All right. Dear doctors, what is the best way to deal with sadness or grief? Sadness of grief. Are there some basic things to do? Specifically, my mother died. She was old. It was time. But I'm still very sad, and it has hit me harder than I expected.
I don't want to... Jen, feel free to jump in with anything, but I don't feel like there's any great prescriptions that I can give a person. I can, there was work done, empirical work done, I don't know, might have been 40 years ago. And it's probably still the industry standard in grief. It was done by Camille Wortman at the University of Michigan. And what she found was she sort of had these little groups of people as she followed them longitudinally after a grief incident. And she said, well, there's like four categories of people, and for sort of four categories of responses. And the, so some people were, got over things very quickly, even major issues. Other people a little bit longer. And then typically there was a grief reaction, a more extended grief reaction would go on, say, a couple of years. And the it was also interesting, some other things that she discovered in doing this. There was no theory behind it. In other words, this was, I think, maybe some of her evidence kind of exploded Kubler-Ross's, you know, stages of grief, which turn out to be just, you know, just sort of an eyeball estimate by an armchair observer that turns out to be, you know, empirically worthless. But it was not a bad guess to just talk about it. So when it comes to grief, it would appear that there's essentially a continuum of how it is that people respond to grief reactions. And of course, the nature of the research that Wortmann did, we wouldn't have been able to study the same person over time in doing this to see whether or not this is effectively a personality issue or whether it's specific to the individual grief reaction. And probably the answer to that, it's probably an interaction. So there's probably going to be individuals who have a longer tail on grief reactions than others, in addition to specific, you know, grief circumstances that are more difficult. So that's a safe answer to say, and I don't know that anybody knows how to tease that out. But what was interesting was pretty striking differences were found in individuals that had experienced major losses, where some people were fine right away and other people were, you know, just coming out of it a couple years later. An additional finding that Wortmann found was that people that were experiencing a lot of negative affect surrounding a grief reaction would also experience oftentimes a fairly normal amount of positive affect. So it's as if that what happened in their life was they became more emotionally turbulent. So they still had positives, but then they also had periods of significant negativity associated with the grief. Another thing that she found was sometimes people would have a lot of guilt as a result of their positive feelings that they would have. So you can sort of see how this works as people halfway extrapolate a loss or someone that they've lost as if that individual is still alive. So we don't necessarily conceptualize them as gone. We sort of hold them in our mind as if they're in some kind of state where they might still be aware of us and therefore sort of halfway living. And if they are gone and we are experiencing some positives, they might be offended by this. If they were, so this is sort of an internal audience process. So we can imagine that this quote doesn't look good, and it's as if it's disrespectful. So the grief process, now, you know, there's individuals that may not ever feel such a thing, but that's a fairly common grief reaction for people to have, is to have that sort of complicated bouncing around of guilt, depression, as well as then positive affect when other things in life go well. So this specific individual is saying it's hit her or him harder than they thought to lose their mother. I could see how that would that happens not infrequently when someone actually is very attached to something or someone, and then when they lose it, they've been so habituated to the existence of that thing or person that they're actually unaware of how important it was to them. This goes, I know this sounds a little strange, but it actually goes back to an emotion theorist, a learning theorist by the name of Henry Solomon, and what's known as opponent process theory, that you can actually be very attached to something, surprisingly, and not know it that much. You can only sort of know it, and then when you lose it, you can really feel it. And so that's probably what happened in this individual's case. And so when you're in a grief process, all that I can say is, you know, maybe the awareness, I'm not sure what might be holding the person back or holding them down. One thing is that you have to go through a major reorganization of the CB matrix inside your mind. So many things change, and when you lose someone super important like your mother, you're also getting a lesson in things like the mortality of yourself. You're also getting a lesson in the fact that our time with some people that are precious to us is limited, and therefore maybe we misinvested our time and didn't spend enough time or energy with them over the time that we did have. And that's a very easy thing for people to do. And in grief reactions, this can be a sort of a signal that there was a process of misinvestment. I can tell you that when I reach my old age and I'm in some trouble and I know I'm going to be gone, I will probably look back at some time that I spent with people that I wasn't that fond of, doing things that I wasn't that fond of doing, and wish that I hadn't given them that time. Because at that point, I will be so aware of the preciousness of the time that we do have. I am aware of it now. I'm a lot more in touch with my mortality now than I was 20 years ago. But I'm probably going to get a lot more in touch with every succeeding year that passes. And so I think part of the grief reaction is also a solemn reminder of our own mortality and the importance of really making super fine choices to really spend our time and energy on the people and things that matter to us and to not give it away. So for this person, you know, it's a learning process. It's a grief process. You will come out of it. And all I can say is you do all the things that would support your life just generally. You know, eat healthy, exercise, get to sleep, try to get some appropriate balance of different things. And it will pass in its own time, and it will pass. And that's really what I know about it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lyle. All right. Well, we're going to change the topic a little bit to a little bit less, little bit different emotions going on, which is the current situation in today's climate. So, dear doctors, why is everyone so divided in today's climate? All the protests, upset over wearing a mask, politics, media hype. I'm having a hard time just being me while being pressured to choose sides.
It sounds like this is a job for a sensitive, psychologically minded political scientist.
Yeah. Well, there are so many different moving parts. I will just, before I totally forget, I wanted to add to the last question too, just really quickly. I think that you touched on the idea of people feeling guilty about the positive emotions when they're supposed to be mourning. And I think that is such a huge component of people's experience, particularly highly conscientious people, where they feel that they're really betraying the person by having any kind of positive experience or by distracting themselves when distracting yourself is in some sense really kind of the correct thing to do, because you're a cost benefit analytic machine, and if you don't have anything else competing for your attention, the death of the loved one is the most relevant thing for your mind to fixate on and to try to solve and to close any open loops that you have around it. And so it's a gift to yourself to give yourself something more relevant to focus on and distract yourself with, but there's that feeling that you're betraying the person. And that's a distortion and something to kind of confront for the more conscientious people among us, because you're sort of sacrificing your own happiness in the moment through this distorted lens that you're somehow doing a disservice to the person who has passed. And that's just not that's not how it is. It's not how it is with a loved one in your family or a pet or anything of that ilk. So I would just, have people sort of look at that and not be afraid to experience joy in their lives and lean into it when you find it, because that's really the whole game. Yeah, so the current moment, why are we so divided? So I think that I'll just sum this up. We'll
sure,
just answer
sum
this.
It up, you know. Don't take too long. 3 minutes.
Just, I'll be super quick. I think the There's so many different angles into this question, and I don't want to, you know, necessarily visit all of them. I would say that the first thing that emerges when anybody asks this question in any context is that it's not as divided as it looks on TV, so or on social media. So I think if people are spending time out in the world, talking to other people, even people with whom they vehemently disagree, almost everybody has that experience where if you actually, you know, put people together, I mean, protests notwithstanding, that's sort of its own unique political situation. But, you know, the actual overlap of confusion and perspective among people is much larger than it looks in terms of what gets headlines and what bleeds and therefore leads. People just really need to remember that the social media and popular media and any form of information that you are consuming anywhere that you find it on TV or on the web is you know selling you information for attention and eyeballs on advertising. And they're harvesting your attention. they're making their entire business all about analyzing what you're paying the most attention to, what gets you most frantic and riled up, what you're sharing on social media, what you're afraid of, what gets you mobilized. And then they're giving you more of that. The whole media experience now is siloing you into whatever direction you've started to head into. And so all of the analytic data processes that are happening with tracking you not only across the web, but what you're buying and where you're going and everything. I mean, this is not tinfoil hat stuff. This is the world that we live in. And so you are a market of one that is being marketed to constantly by advertisers who understand impeccably well your big five far better than you do and what you're most afraid of and what's most mobilizing to you. And so you are receiving a view of the world that is the most motivating for you to take action around those things. And it is not actually out there on a day-to-day existence as polarized and as terrifying as it looks from that perspective when you're behind the screen. So, and that you just hear that over and over again from experts in all different realms who are, you know, actually dealing with this and trying to inform people that it's so easy to fall into that trap that it's all this us against them kind of thinking. And it's not that that's not there at all. I mean, obviously there is with, you know, certainly with COVID and with Black Lives Matter. And I mean, it's just, it's something new every day that there is there's a confluence of forces and incentives that are reconfirming people's membership in these, you know, tribal affiliations. And we've talked about a lot of these on the podcast before. I've written about them in a couple of articles that you can read on our website. We have other material. We may talk about it. We're doing a live Q&A for the members of our website this weekend. I think on Saturday, right, Doug?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. So if people want to, if you're a member of the new website, it is steamdynamics.com, or you want to sign up, we'll discuss some of this then as well, because we've been getting a lot of questions about it. But it's the sort of built-in intense incentives that we have to spread bad news, to take responsibility for bad news, because it has this huge evolutionary advantage if we can share it with other people first. And then the way in which social media has made, I have just never seen anything like it that began with COVID and is now, you know, sort of just the new normal as far as spreading information online, where people are asserting themselves as these arbiters and entrepreneurs of information and making themselves an expert in the place of other experts. So it's like, oh, I have harvested all of this data and I'm putting it together for your consumption and you should follow me. And there's just so much of that. And it's so this false equivalency that's happening and this anti-establishment conspiracy thinking and all of these different things happening at once that, again, are being funneled into your individual experience of what is happening in the world, which is being fed to you by the overlords of data analytics. So your reality does not look like your neighbor's reality because of the things that you have already read and because of the tracking that has already happened with your activity on the web. So I just want people to kind of, before they get too concerned about the world being more polarized than it has ever been in this particularly dichotomous way, just to be aware that you are the product. You are being created by these processes, and being sold your own fear in a very real sense for really the first time in this kind of significant way.
Wonderful, Dr. Hawk. Yeah. Thank you.
Super, super complicated and a little chilling.
Yeah, it should be chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to be, mm-hmm. I don't want to scaremonger about it, but I think people need to be intensely aware, we talk all the time about controlling your environment, determining your own environment, your personal utopia, but and how a huge piece of that is your information environment. Mm-hmm. But this is like the nature of nurture that Plowman talks about. Like, you are creating that environment through your own activity, and really largely unaware of the ways in which the things that are most salient for you to take action on, whether positive or negative. But we know from Kahneman and Tversky and others that we're much more oriented toward threat than gain. Something that is threatening to our existence is way more mobilizing than something that we could maybe just benefit from, because it's way more important to take action against that. See, Motown agrees with me.
Yes.
it's way more important to take action against something that could pose some sort of mortal danger to you that you have to act on now than something that has some uncertain benefit out in the future that, it would be nice to have the extra points, but it's not going to be as immediately mobilizing as something we're afraid of. And big data understands this completely. Mm-hmm. Modern politics understands this completely. And we are all individually right in the web of it. Consuming it all the time, whether we're aware of it or not. And it doesn't mean that you need to be terrified and paranoid, and God knows I don't want people to be even more conspiratorial with their thinking about the world. But just be aware that what you think is true is it's a fractal of the truth that you have consumed through your own consumer choices on the web and in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm better off sometimes when I'll just completely ignore all news for a couple of weeks, just forget it. And I find that my own anxiety about whatever it is just starts dropping within a matter of hours, and within a couple of days, it's like, oh, no, the world's pretty much the way it's always been, as long as I don't tune into the news. But if I do tune into the news, I'm hearing a thunder shower of anxiety. And so, yeah, forget it. Yeah, here we are, and pretty much the world is, more or less close to the way I left it in February. It's not that much different. There's some differences, but it's not, there's differences in issues, but it is 99%+ the same world we've always had.
Yeah. Well, here in Southern California, there was the most incredible fireworks that I've ever seen. So I guess the governor of our state canceled 4th of July, and there was a lot of people in protest that were lighting off fireworks like they've never been seen before. So I wonder if it's going to be like this when they cancel 4th of July. Maybe a lot of people want 4th of July to be canceled from now on.
Yeah, I think you see this exaggerated tribal behavior when people are among their like-minded tribe. Mm-hmm. When you're going to a protest and you know that everybody's going to basically be in agreement with you and seeing the world in a similar way, then it looks like then you've got the CB on expressing yourself in that direction is so much better because you have all of the social insurance surrounding you. But if you put people in, a mixed situation, like I just had to travel last week. So I was on a plane wearing my mask, and everybody else is wearing their mask. And some people are clearly more, grudging about it than others. But everybody's more or less like cooperating and following the rules. And you don't have half the plane that's saying, give me, you know, no mask or give me death or whatever it is. Like there's no giant protest. There's no polarized environment when people are sort of forced into a situation that has a cooperative goal that is larger than they are. But if they're embedded in a group of people that is amplifying their own self-interest and their own worldview, it's very easy to move into that exaggerated position, and then it gets play on the evening news because it's got this threat representativeness, and it's very it's going to get more advertising. So we're just living in this bubble of our own making, where when you really go out into the real world, whether it's the grocery store or an airplane or you know, just wandering down the street, it looks very much like business as usual because people are just cooperating like they always have to cooperate to kind of just keep the wheels on the bus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I read in Evolution of Desire by David Buss, and I learned from you, Dr. Lyle, early on in the podcast that when men lose their jobs and lose employment, they're just more like, that's the most likely time that the woman will either leave them or cheat. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious if there, you know, if you think that there will be a new CB that, you know, women will start to leave the non-essential workers for the more essential workers, if the division kind of continues.
Where are they going to go?
No, I mean, leave them relationships, like because the essential workers are now employed and the non-essential workers are underemployed.
Yeah, this is all ending pretty soon. And so, you know, they're whatever the controversies are and the difficulties there are in trying to figure out the best path forward for the economy, it's going to come back together in relatively short order to relatively normal. There's just too much incentive for that to happen. So it'll be interesting in retrospect whether or not anybody can ever want to collect data and track things like that and test evolutionary hypotheses, you know, post hoc. And somebody might do that. So we may see something that looks like that once again, but we've seen it before in any recession or any, you could just watch people with job loss specifically without waiting for a crisis. But we could see a spike of disruption in romantic relationships and, you know, pair bonds. Wouldn't surprise me any. Economic calamity is going to do that. But yeah, I don't think it's anything new. I think this is, you know, the world's always had waves of trouble. And the waves of trouble, they disrupt, you know, a lot of the way systems are working. There's going to be poverty and there's going to be, in this case, relative poverty, not poverty the way I saw poverty when I was, you know, if you're in the third world or the way I saw it in 1964. But you're going to see economic hardship is what I would call it. And you're going to see, and we've seen some tragedy with respect to people, you know, people's health. And we see some alarming disruption in social processes. So there's trouble, and there always is. And you essentially have equilibrium, and then you have disruption. And that's so we're in a period of disruption now. It will pass, and we will return to equilibrium at some point, probably, you know, reasonably soon.
Wonderful. I guess I'm showing my data and my phone and my tracking device.
It cracks me up every time I see some reference to all the COVID babies that are going to be born in December and January. It's like, really? Now, if anything, we're going to see declining birth rates. all the relationships that have hit the rocks. It'll be very interesting to watch like how the data bears out all these various hypotheses that people have of, you know, whether people are brought together, like does this sort of thing bring out the best or worst in people or both, and in what ways? And so there's a million different hypotheses that will launch a million different dissertations in the next decade. But it is, yeah,
I guess
it's an interesting idea.
Our cookies, I guess.
Well, and I think women the non-essential to essential worker, I mean, there's a lot of the non-essential workers who are unemployed are sufficiently high status, like they have high enough status because of their their dismissal. You know, there's too many components of that CB for that female leaving a high status male for an essential worker who has a job, for example. I think it's going to be way too noisy. You'd have to look at very, very specific groups under very specific intents and constraints. But it'd be interesting. I mean, there's so many untested questions. I think I'm a little less optimistic than Doug is in general of a return to normalcy anytime soon. I'm not in the next year not normal as we like to think of normal. Just because I think, I'm watching academia in particular making big decisions about the coming fall semester and, you know, all of Harvard's classes, for example, I just got an email today, they're all going online. And some students will be back on campus, but they're not going to class on campus and they have to sign, like a social distancing oath to be there. So the whole collegiate experience is different this fall. And I think fall takes us into flu season. And we've got, you've got a whole renewed season of distress and panic and renewed kind of lockdown to some degree. So I think, you know, maybe by this time next year, we're emerging into some sunshine, but I don't know. The next few months with the election and going into the fall have me a little bit, they have my political science hat a little concerned.
Interesting. Now I got,
I'm watching more news than you are.
Sure. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. I've sort of given up worrying too much about COVID. We haven't done a talk about it in a while. The only things I'm particularly interested in is I'm interested in the death counts. And I'm interested in one other thing. So the death counts in the United States are very low. It's at the tail end of a distribution, just like we would have expected it. A little longer for the U.S. than for other countries because we're such a large country. It's sort of gone sideways as it's gone into different locations. So it's as if we were four countries in Europe, not one. And so we're in a sort of a sequence process. But nevertheless, we still see our death rates very low. Even as cases, quote, spike, we're still seeing the death rates low. So the spiking is an artifact of a variety of factors, including more testing, including identification of maybe more people that are not particularly ill, et cetera. But so I don't know if we're going to see a death rate rise or not that's substantial. But at any rate, I forget. I'm sort of lost. What was I even saying? Yeah, I don't know what I was saying. And in other words,
how worried we should be.
Like, how worried am I? In other words, another thing that has caught my attention is the stats from the CDC, which indicate how many deaths are expected on a weekly basis in the United States in any given week of the year. And so it changes from week to week. It's somewhere between 50 and 60,000.
Important reference.
Right. And so I look at that and I see clearly that we see that COVID's extra deaths in the United States are now a very small fraction. And so in other words, it's pretty well back to normal with respect to health of people in the United States. And we can also now, we can look forward to, right now it's more or less 100,000 excess deaths, even though the counts online might say 130 or 140. But when you actually look at how many deaths were expected as a result of an average over the last 3 or 4 years in the United States, if it was 56,002 people on this week last year, and it's 56,009 people this year, then we know that there's no excess deaths attributable to COVID. And so that's how we can tease out this mathematical problem. And so it looks like COVID's about done in the United States, and the death toll's about 100,000, which is remarkably similar to what the University of Washington projection was 2 months ago or so at 93,000. And so it looks like, in other words, this is the nature of this beast, and we don't really know how much any of the social distancing and mask wearing and anything else has really had an influence on it. Undoubtedly had an influence on this spreading it out over time, which is caused the health systems to not be overwhelmed, which is terrific. But it looks like this is kind of what the toll was, but we actually don't know about what this really means. For example, if we were looking at the end of year statistics. So it looks like the worst case scenario for this wave of COVID is on the order of 100,000 deaths, excess deaths, as opposed, you know, instead of having 2.8 million deaths this year, at this moment, we would anticipate 2.9. But we may not get 2.9 because it could be that 30 or 40,000 of these deaths might have taken place in the next 6 months by the end of this year. So it could be that at the end of this year, we look back over our shoulders at COVID and we find 2.85, in other words, 2,850,000 deaths instead of an expected rate of 2,800,000, then we'll know that COVID really took 50,000 lives more than 6 months to a year early. And that was the cost of COVID. So, but anyway, as I see the COVID numbers fade to a very sane and reasonable and reasonably predictable level, you know, I wonder at how much hysteria we're going to be looking at 90 days from now. Maybe we still will. As Jen's suggesting, you know, this is a virtual reality program that's being fed to people and they're pushing the buttons. And so,
and it's a presidential election.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So the stakes are very high. And so, yeah, to be clear, like I'm not, it's two separate concepts. One
sure.
is the empirical reality of COVID's toll, and the other is the
right.
the risk averse political matrix that emerges to accommodate it
right.
and to, you know, that is very much more sensitive to threat than to gain.
Yes.
And so the correct thing to do if you're a politician is to overreact and to lock down and to freak people out and to, and because that is such a reinforced process through social media, I am not seeing that ending in the next, you know, through next winter with a impending next flu season and a second wave and everything else. So I would like to think that it would in the face of the kind of, you know, actual death rate that we're talking about and the reality of it, but I'm not as optimistic.
Right. Just for our listeners that may not be in touch with this or not care or just have shrugged their shoulders and aren't listening, it appears that just as I was hoping, that our ability to deal with COVID once you're infected or you're seriously ill appears to be much, much better now than it was 90 days ago. So this is actually striking. In other words, I would have expected chipping away at it in little chunks that we might be 10% better than we were, you know, after 3 months, another 10% better. And I expected humanity over the next 2 or 3 years to be very effective at chipping this thing down to much safer. It turns out that they've worked at warp speed. They are way better at treating COVID now. So apparently the risk factor has dropped by maybe more than 50%, maybe 70 or 80% difference. And so this is extraordinary. And so so as these realities, you know, of course, you're not going to hear a lot of news about it, as Jen would say, you know what I mean? And so I think that reality is, you know, seeping its way into the medical profession as people understand now there's procedures for managing this that are far, far better than they have been, apparently. But, you know, it's going to take time before the obsessiveness and worry, you know, fades for various reasons. So, but I feel heartened. I feel like it's probably true that if you're 50 years old and in reasonably good health and you got COVID and you have type A blood and you've got a reasonably bad case of it, you know, where your odds, whatever your odds were X percentage, you know, 3 months ago, those odds are now a lot less that it would take your life. So, hey, human beings, ingenuity, progress, we'll get there.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much for coming on, and we'll look forward to talking to you, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle, next week.
Thank you,
Sounds
Nathan.
Good. Talk next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.